This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we pivot to Asia. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. In July, a United Nations tribunal rules that China's sovereignty claims over the South China Sea and its aggressive attempts to enforce them violate international law. In September, President Obama takes his 11th and last trip to Asia to attend the G20 summit in China and the ASEAN summit in Laos, where he presses for the ratification of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. North Korea launches its fifth nuclear test in defiance of the international community, and 2 weeks later, it successfully tests a new rocket engine that would be used to launch satellites, again, in violation of UN sanctions. Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader of Myanmar, visits Washington a day after President Obama announces the U.S. government is prepared to lift economic sanctions against her country. When U.S. President Barack Obama entered office in 2008, he wanted to turn to Asia after years of focusing on terrorism and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He has worked throughout his 2 4-year terms to bolster America's power and influence in Asia. However, the future of his strategic rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region and his legacy there are still uncertain. Well, with us for an update on Asia and an assessment of President Obama's rebalance policy are two distinguished regional analysts. Michael Fuchs is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, that's a think tank here in Washington, and Dean Chung. He's a senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
Let me turn to you first, Michael Fuchs. Let's talk about North Korea off the bat, because really this is extremely provocative. It set off its fifth nuclear test in defiance of UN resolutions. And then Pyongyang, as I said in the introduction, said this week that it successfully tested a high-powered rocket engine for launching satellites, raising again concerns that it's making progress in developing a long-range ballistic missile. And we know also that the United States is flying bombers over South Korea as a show of force and U.S. commitment to preserve the security of the peninsula. Why does Pyongyang continue with this provocative and illegal behavior?
I think that North Korea continues with this sort of provocative behavior because the leader there and his regime believe that it is imperative to their regime stability. I think that the international community, the United States, the UN Security Council, and others have made it clear that North Korea needs to denuclearize and needs to end its provocative actions and end its ballistic missile program. And I think that the responses that you're seeing now from the United States in particular fall into two baskets. The first is the deterrence aspect of this and making sure that the United States is committed to strengthening its alliances with South Korea, with Japan in particular. And you've seen that, I think, with the flights that you mentioned in recent weeks, as well as the decision to deploy THAAD in South Korea, and the strengthening of trilateral U.S.-Japan-Korean relations in recent years. The second basket, I think, is the pressure side of things. And this obviously takes time, but the recent Security Council resolutions that deployed new sanctions in March can help push North Korea harder. And I think now after these most recent tests, I think that you see the United States and others going back to work with China and push China to help both implement those recent sanctions as well as to potentially look for new ways to pressure the North Korean regime.
Let me now turn to Dean Chung for your take on why North Korea continues with these provocative actions under Kim Jong-un. And do you think that the international community, the United States in particular, and China are using the tools necessary to deter and to punish North Korea?
Well, to begin with, why the North Koreans are behaving this way, I agree with Mike that part of this is aimed at deterring the United States, part of this is aimed at pressuring South Korea, part of this is aimed at a domestic audience within North Korea to demonstrate the capabilities of the Kim family. It's important to remember that the nuclear program draws its lineage to Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father. But whether or not we are doing enough, I would say that, frankly, we are not. while we are now starting to impose additional sanctions on North Korea, it is sobering to think that North Korea is actually less sanctioned than Zimbabwe, which, as far as we know, does not, in fact, have a nuclear weapons program, and that we continue not to apply the full range of options. So, for example, to what extent are we applying the banking system, as we did back in 2005 against Banco Delta Asia, to pressure not only North Korean financial institutions, but also Chinese financial institutions, which are a primary conduit for North Korea to access the rest of the world. We see basically a lot of rhetoric, and rhetoric is important, and we see the UN, you know, resolutions and the like. But again, we keep hoping against hope that China will actually do something. When there have been recent news reports, for example, that China continues to invest in a key port facility up in northeast North Korea, and despite claims that they have reduced trade relations and the like, it seems that rail and road traffic across the Yalu River has only dropped very slightly.
Well, back to you, Michael, to talk more about why China isn't doing more to contain North Korea. What other tools does the United States have, the international community? You mentioned the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea, but I don't believe China is in favor of that. So how can that actually be implemented?
Well, I think that the THAAD shows the North Koreans that the United States and South Korea and its allies are going to continue to mount a robust defense and deterrent capability against North Korea, while at the same time showing Beijing that the United States is going to take actions that Beijing is not necessarily going to like the longer that North Korea's programs continue to persist and advance.
Back to you once again, Dean Chung, and that is regarding sanctioning Chinese firms that are conducting business with North Korea. We recently saw action in this regard whereby the United States and China have targeted a Chinese firm whose head is suspected of having a role in supporting Kim Jong-un's nuclear arms program. Is that a positive cooperation, and can we see more of that?
You've asked the two key questions. Is it a positive sign? Absolutely. Will we see more of that? There's the rub. It is one company out of many. And one of the things to keep in mind is that the way the sanctions were written up, there is a giant exception for quote-unquote humanitarian assistance. Whether or not the North Korean people ever actually see any of those materials is very much in question. I think it is safe to say that so long as that exception is there, Kim Jong-un is not going to be missing too many meals.
Well, turning back to you, Michael Fuchs, let's talk about the South China Sea, China's provocative actions. We noticed over the summer that the Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration found that China's main claim to the sea had really no legal basis. But unfortunately, the ruling has no enforcement mechanism. So where does that leave us, the United States and its allies in the region?
Well, I think that the ruling, which was a very authoritative and comprehensive statement about the illegality of China's claims in the South China Sea, and frankly, criticizing many of the provocative actions that China has taken to assert its authority in certain areas in the South China Sea. But I think it is a very stark reminder of how difficult this challenge is, and frankly, how long it is likely going to take to find some resolution to it. I think that the Hague ruling was very important in terms of showing the entire international community that an impartial international legal body has now declared that China's claims and therefore also some of its activities are invalid. But I do think, again, China is going to continue to push forward on this front, which means the United States, along with many of its friends and allies in the region and elsewhere, are going to need to continue to push back even more in a variety of different ways.
So push back even more, Dean Chung, but how? How does the United States and its allies do that? We heard, obviously, rhetoric from President Obama just recently at the UN General Assembly, sort of calling out Beijing for its activities in the South China Sea. We have this ruling, but what are the penalties for Beijing if China continues to ignore this Hague ruling?
Well, thus far, the penalties, even before the ruling, were minimal from the United States. It was revealed in congressional testimony last year that the United States had not conducted a Freedom of Navigation operation, or a FONOP, in the area of the Spratly Islands for 3 years. I mean, the message that that clearly sends to Beijing is, during which time, by the way, they were busily building these artificial islands, that Beijing can build these islands and there will not be a downside consequence from the United States. In fact, during the same period, the United States openly invited China twice, not once, but twice, to the Rim of the Pacific exercises, the largest multinational exercises in the Pacific. In 2014, the Chinese showed up not only with a naval delegation, but with spy ships, which the commander of Pacific Command at the time actually welcomed, stating, "This proves that China accepts our definition of freedom of the seas," which the Chinese then promptly demonstrated they did not. So you can't beat something with nothing, as the saying goes. And when the Chinese are building islands, and the best we do is rhetoric, but we still refrain from doing actual FONOPs, what we have done so far, quote-unquote, innocent passage exercises, it's very hard to imagine that China is going to take our rhetoric seriously.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Dean Chung, from whom you just heard. He's a senior research fellow at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. And Michael Fuchs. He's former Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He's currently a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're discussing U.S.-Asia policy in the waning days of the Obama administration. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now, here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Monrovia, John T. Tarpe. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Tell us what you've learned about this week's Asia update. Well, back to you, Michael Fuchs, continuing on about China, its activities in the South China Sea, its cyber espionage against the United States. I mean, there are a range of things in which they display themselves as major adversaries, obviously, to the United States. But at the same time, we sort of need their help, you know, with respect to North Korea. How can we recalibrate this relationship where, you know, we can certainly be a part of sanctioning them for these very provocative activities in the South China Sea?
Well, I think that's exactly the right question. This gets at the heart of the matter right now in Asia and with respect to the Obama administration's rebalance or pivot policy in the last 7+ years. China is rising rapidly and changing the region. And in some ways, it is acting assertively, acting provocatively. And what the United States needs to do and has been doing, I think, over the last 7+ years, but needs to continue to do more of, is shape the environment in Asia so that, one, we have the best chance possible of building that kind of relationship with China that enables us to do exactly what you said. Cooperate where necessary, but push back and change their behavior in areas where we disagree and where they are threatening our interests. But at the same time, we need to make sure that our position elsewhere in the region, our alliances, our partnerships, our military presence are prepared both to deter as well as to deal with any contingencies that might arise.
Back to you, Dean Chung, to talk about also the Philippines, because, of course, the Philippines was the country that brought this case against China and its activities in the South China Sea to The Hague. But we now have a Philippines under a different leader, President Rodrigo Duterte, and he's sort of upended Philippine politics. He's strained our longstanding ties with the Philippines, that is the United States. He insulted President Obama recently when he was in the region. He withdrew support for joint patrols of the disputed South China Sea before he, I think, reinstated them. Talk about the Philippines as an important longstanding ally. Is that relationship in peril under the presidency of Duterte?
I think one of the important things to recognize is that when you have democracies, as you do in Manila as well as here in Washington, you wind up electing people who may not always see eye to eye with the previous administration in country. Clearly, Mr. Duterte disagrees with his predecessor and also with the President of the United States. Now, that's obviously not an excuse for insulting language, which really did break diplomatic precedent. But the reality is that American policy towards the region, therefore, should not be focused on individual personalities or a specific country. We need to take that step back and look at the region as a whole. If the Philippines is choosing to take a more conciliatory attitude towards China, which is obviously their right, there are other players, be it Vietnam, be it Malaysia, Taiwan, is another claimant to the South China Sea. All of these are also players. The issue of the long game goes to the idea of having a strategy that we pursue consistently, regardless of changes on individual players.
Well, turning back to you, Michael Fuchs, for anything to add or subtract with regard to the Philippines or what Dean just said about our strategy, that is U.S. strategy in the region with our allies, Vietnam, Philippines, and so forth.
Well, yeah, I definitely agree with Dean's characterization of U.S. strategy needing to be consistent. The United States needs to pursue policies that are consistent with our own interests, and that includes our long-term alliance with the Philippines, as well as diversifying our partnerships in the region with other countries, including Vietnam and Malaysia and beyond. I think with respect to Philippines and its new leader, he is obviously a very colorful individual. The ups and downs, I think, are going to be more extreme, perhaps, than they have been in the past. But I also do think that Duterte has also shown that he believes that the United States alliance is important for the Philippines, despite some of the things that he has said. And I believe that the alliance will weather whatever storms.
Well, Dean Chung, let's look at a potential bright spot. Myanmar, de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, recently visited the United States. Discuss the significance of her visit and this burgeoning U.S.-Myanmar relationship.
Well, I think that this is a bright spot. I think that the movement of the Yangon, formerly Rangoon government, towards greater democratization, towards a greater incorporation of the broad spectrum of Myanmar society represented by Aung San Suu Kyi is very important. The U.S. has played an important role in shepherding this along, but we should also, again, be very careful in what our expectations. Unfortunately, Burma/Myanmar has a record of two steps forward, one step back. Anyone who thinks that the country is now firmly pro-U.S. or pro-West needs to look at the history. There is a certain amount of xenophobia. Historically, there has been a swing from China to the West and back again, and I fully expect that we will see in the longer term a set of balancing behavior by the authorities there, no matter who's in power, to walk that fine line among the major powers of the United States, China, etc.
And to you, Michael Fuchs, for your take on the burgeoning relationship started under President Obama vis-a-vis Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi's historic visit to the country, and the potential for these economic sanctions, the remaining sanctions to be lifted.
Let's remember what is most significant about the changes that have happened in Myanmar over the last handful of years, which is the importance of them for the people of the country themselves. This is a country that has been living under a military dictatorship for decades. The repression, the economic stagnation has been horrendous. And just in the matter of a few years, the environment has changed. The military has shed much of its power. Aung San Suu Kyi, which when President Obama came into office was under house arrest, is now visiting the Oval Office. And if you go to the country, you can see in a very tangible way the changes in daily lives for people there. But again, I would also introduce a note of caution along with Dean that in some ways the easy things have been done. Now it's the hard task of actually having those institutional and political reforms take root. And this is going to be a huge task for the people of Myanmar, in which the United States is trying to help, I think, by loosening the sanctions repeatedly over the last handful of years.
In terms of loosening those sanctions, when do you expect that to happen, Dean Chung? Is there any pushback at all from members of Congress?
I think Congress in general is supportive of the idea of basically providing carrots to the authorities in Yangon to make sure that they see that as long as you are liberalizing, there will be benefits.
Well, as we close, Michael Fuchs, I want to turn back to you and talk about the TPP, because in an answer to one of my first questions, you said that the United States needs to do more to shape the environment in Asia. And I think probably there's no other policy that would do more than the TPP, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact, which President Obama has been touting, has been defending. He made a very forceful case for its ratification while he was in Laos at the ASEAN summit. And without it, President Obama said, quote, "We would be ceding the region to countries like China, who do not set the same types of high standards for trade agreements." However, as we know, we're in a presidential election year. Both major party presidential candidates, including Hillary Clinton, who was previously in favor of the TPP, have come out against it. So do you see, as many analysts have said, that the TPP is really crucial? It's like the crux of this rebalance to Asia, and that without it, the United States may lose clout to China and even dent President Obama's legacy.
There's no doubt about it. The TPP is important. I do not believe, however, that this is the ball game, if you will, when it comes to the United States policy in Asia, when it comes to the Obama administration's rebalance of the region. There are a variety of different things that the administration has been doing, I think, to increase U.S. position to advance its interests in the region, both on the security and the political and the economic side. So if TPP does not go through, yes, I think it will hurt U.S. interests in Asia, without a doubt. But it is in no way, shape, or form, I think, the whole ball game.
Dean Chung, how do you see the TPP as an important part, if not the most important part, of U.S. rebalancing to Asia?
Well, the administration, to its credit, embodied the TPP as part of the Asia pivot to make the point that the pivot was not just a military program, but included a trade component. Again, if we look at President Obama, who has been one of our most eloquent presidents, when speaking in support of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, he was very, very powerful. When he talks about violence in the United States and the need for gun control, he's very, very eloquent and very, very persistent in making the case. But on TPP and trade policy in general, the silence has been far more thunderous than the commentary from the White House. Yes, he has made some comments in support of it, but the bully pulpit has too often been vacant.
But don't you think he feels a bit constrained because he really takes a position that's a bit in contrast to the majority of Democrats, certainly those in Congress, vis-a-vis trade? He's really more aligned with many Republicans who are traditionally seen as more pro-trade agreements. So that may be part of it.
The president has been willing to express positions that are not popular with Republicans, Democrats, and at times the broad majority of the American public on issues that he really cares about. Gun control is a good example. I would be very surprised if the leader of the free world on an issue that he helped introduce was going to now cede that floor to the Democrats in Congress, who, by the way, not all of them are opposed. And many of those who are in support, that represents significant jobs as well.
Well, turning back to you, Michael Fuchs, because you worked in the administration, perhaps you have some insight with respect to President Obama's position and whether or not he pushed hard enough or where we are now in the final hours. Because many see this, we've had programs on this topic before, that it's more than just a trade agreement. It really is a strategic policy.
I think that while, yes, this is very strategically important to the United States in Asia, I think one of the things that we all have to remember, and especially those, I think, in the region, is that these discussions happen within the context of what is best for American workers and American jobs and American growth. And that is a vigorous debate that happens constantly here in the United States. So I think that's the first thing to remember. The second thing I think to remember is that the biggest thing about U.S. economic interests in Asia is the U.S. economy. The stronger and more dynamic and more innovative the U.S. economy, the more investment and the more trade that will happen with the countries of Asia. And I think that regardless of whether or not TPP goes forward, if you look right now at the numbers, U.S. trade, U.S. investment in countries across Asia are at top or near the top in many places. And that, I think, will continue as long as the United States economy here at home continues its dynamism and continues to grow.
And the last word to you, Dean Chung. How do our Asian allies see the fate of the TPP and those who are signatories, whether it's Vietnam, Philippines, others in the region? If the United States does not ratify the TPP, will they perceive the United States as losing influence, and will they be more willing to go into the arms of China, or how do you see it?
I don't know that they will necessarily go into the arms of China, but they will certainly be questioning American leadership. They will certainly be questioning where the United States is heading. They are certainly going to be questioning what is the future of free trade across the entire Pacific, which encompasses many of the most productive, most innovative economies. So I don't think it is possible to say that the failure of TPP would be anything other than, at the end of the day, a net strategic loss.
We will see what happens before the end of the year, I'm afraid. For now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Michael Fuchs. He's former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Dean Chung. He's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jonah Cummings. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.